What's up, people? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety Podcast on YouTube. This week, we're talking all about workout height with a little bit of a different perspective. We've got Dan with us. Dan's got an extensive offshore experience, and he's going to really bring that kind of offshore perspective, whilst I'm going to bring that onshore perspective. Let's get into the podcast.
Health and safety is almost a victim of its own success.
We need an oppressive regime of health and safety regulations.
A huge fire engulfs a tower block in London.
Children being forced to wear goggles to play conkers at school.
Worst oil field disaster, 164 dead.
Rebranding Safety, the modern health and safety podcast, crushing the stereotype. And your host, James McPherson.
We've got our first ever overseas guest, so Daniel is coming on. He's going to talk with me about working at height. So welcome to the podcast, Daniel.
Yeah, thanks very much, mate. Glad to be here with you.
Cool. Why don't you just take us through your kind of journey? I mean, I've checked you out on LinkedIn. It looks like a very interesting journey to your career in health and safety. So why don't you take us on a little trip?
Yeah, thanks. Well, I've been in industry for about 28 years, but only the last 10's health and safety. I was on large cruise ships for a long time, and they sort of injected occupational safety while I was there. We sort of mainly focused on marine safety. We didn't have that occupational safety side of things, and it was quite refreshing to see it from that aspect. So I got involved with it there, and then headhunted for a large oil and gas company in the Middle East. And they moved me into safety and compliance, and I've been doing that for the last sort of 7 years out here. I'm currently working for a division that supports upstream and downstream operations in the Gulf, and we have about 180 vessels, supply vessels, crew boats and that. So we basically support them with crew, working platforms for the work they need to do, like offshore maintenance. And my job is just to make sure that all our eggs are in a basket in terms of safety and compliance. So it's a massive operation. We run our boats on ISM and also corporate safety management system. So it's busy, a lot to do, but a lot of fun and quite rewarding.
And you get to travel the world, I assume. You're in Saudi Arabia now.
Yeah, sort of mainly in the Gulf region, so not too much traveling anymore, but that's what it is, eh?
Yeah, fair enough. Have you always been a keen traveller?
Yeah, I love it, mate, absolutely love it, getting around and experiencing different cultures, meeting different people, you know. I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's a beautiful world.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you know, I've had kind of like an awesome insight into working at height. Like, it must be a massively different game, like working at height on ships and boats and offshore and stuff like that. Obviously, you know, one thing we look for on the land is like stable ground, but I suppose you never really get that on sea.
Yeah, you don't, and there's a lot of things you've got to you've got to look at, you know. Particularly when I was on the big ships, we used to do a lot of work over the side. You've got to keep those ships clean, and you can't. There's no sort of looking at the hazard, because you've got guys moving from into sky cons, into bosun's chairs, and you know you've got to look at things like specialized personal fall arrest systems with inbuilt harnesses and inflatable life jackets. But you know it doesn't. Everything is not always the same. Every risk is different. When the guy's climbing from the deck into a skycon, he's got to be, you know, hooked in a different way. When he's in the skycon itself, you've got to look at things like if he's hooked into that and it breaks and falls into the water, he's going to go down with it. So, I mean, you've got to be sort of on your game, and you've got to look at these dynamic risks because it's changing all the time.
Would you do more work on maybe like competency of the person then, do you suppose? Like you mentioned like dynamic risks, so like dynamic risk assessment, the employees being able to like assess on a penny, I suppose, is for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, that's particularly important for us. I would say more so now, where most of our operation is remote, Obviously, a lot of the infrastructure that we have is pretty old, from the 50s and 60s, and wasn't really built with full protection in mind. So in terms, if we look at the hierarchy of controls, you know, we're sort of missing those first three steps. We can't eliminate, we can't substitute, we can't really engineer. We can build specialized scaffolding, but at the end of the day, we're looking at the last two, really admin. So you're looking at the competency of your workers, of course, and we try and send our workers offshore trained up already. A key aspect of our training is hazard recognition. So we have a very, very intensive two-day program just on hazard recognition, and then obviously the specialized fall protection and working at heights training before they even get out there. So it's really crucial to us.
Mm. Hazard recognition, that sounds interesting. Why don't you take me through like a whistle-stop tour of what your interpretation of that is?
So basically, what we want the guy who's going into the going into offshore, we want him to be at a certain level that he could recognize the basic hazards around him, because we've really got to try and inject safety into operations. We've got thousands of employees working offshore. We can't have armies of safety monitors and safety professionals monitoring them all the time. We really have to rely on operations and those guys in the front line to look after their own safety. And one of the key things is, you know, can you recognize basic hazards? Obviously, you know, we got guys from all over the world and different levels of education and training, but we need to get them to a certain standard of being able to recognize these hazards. So we put them through quite an intensive two-day program. They've got an exam in that to pass as well. They've got to show their competency before we even let them go there. And that's then before they'll go into any sort of specialized fall protection and working at heights training as well.
So you're trying to hit it from the offset before they even get offshore.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've really got to try and inject that that awareness of what's going to hurt you into them, so that they don't, you know, they're not just standing back relying on the safety officer or the foreman, or, you know, each guy's got to be responsible, because the conditions out there, they can change quite rapidly. You know, it's not like being on a building site. You've got moving vessels. It's very dynamic. These offshore structures are covered in salt. You know, they're very slippery. There's oil. So there's a lot more to it than you would get on land or in other traditional sort of construction sites.
Do you think complacency is kind of less of an issue offshore? Because I mean, on land, I think complacency is probably one of the biggest things that we struggle with. You know, I mean, just the other day I was driving past a construction site and stuck in traffic and could just see this young lad climbing up the outside of a scaffold. And I think it's that kind of, that you're just not aware of the risk, because I suppose on land it's easier for us to design and engineer out and eliminate as many risks as possible, that people are now complacent to it. And like you said earlier, that's very difficult to do offshore and on ships.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that it's a difficult topic, that, you know, some people, they hate using that word complacency, but you know, it can creep in, I think you've got to, you know, I know it's cliched when we say this, but you've really got to inject that culture into your organization, and we have a good culture here. We have to, with the operation so spread out and so big and so dynamic and so busy all the time. If it's not there in these far out locations, 80, 90 miles offshore, you know, in 40 knot winds and dust storms and that, and complacency sets in, we're going to have problems. We're going to have, you know, fatalities and people falling, and, you know, we've got the water to then worry about as well. So, you know, we really have to make sure that the culture is good and that complacency doesn't creep in.
It baffles me that, like, you know, we just, still can't really seem to get working at height. I mean, falls from height still in 2017 to 18, it was still the biggest cause of fatalities. I mean, I suppose the argument could be made that the likelihood of dying from falling from height compared to a lot of other injuries is kind of ingrained in the work, maybe, but surely a fall isn't ingrained in working at height, is it? You know, you would expect to work at height without falling.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know why at every year we look at these stats and it's the same over, you know, working at heights, high scores of fatalities, you know, slips, trips and falls. And I don't know as a collective industry why, you know, the figures are telling us one thing. So what are we doing to target it? You know, we get the same thing over and over. And yet, I don't know, we don't seem to, as you know, safety professionals, I don't know how we don't seem to move forward and really target it and look at why and really attack these behaviors before they become an issue.
Yeah, I think that is an awesome point. You know, why can we not sort this out? I had a very interesting conversation with a good friend of mine. He's a builder and he works a lot on like house building and stuff. And I said to him I saw this young lad climbing up the outside of scaffolding. And I said, does that happen a lot, or is it just by chance that I drove past? And he was like, nah, it happens all the time. And it just blew my mind to think we're still struggling with this. And I think it's not a one trick pony. There's never like a magic wand you can wave. It's always a collection of loads of things. But one thing that we had a good chat about was like just taking scaffolding around the house, for example, always designing one single entrance, access and egress points. So if you're on one far corner of the house and it's lunchtime, for example, they have to walk all the way around the scaffold and an exit. And I was like, well, if they put an exit at each corner, do you think that would resolve it? And he was like, well, it would definitely take like 2/3 of it away, wouldn't it? And I just thought, is it simple things like that we're missing?
Yeah, I mean, and that's how we've got to think. And I think we can only get that kind of those kind of results or those kind of ideas if we have that dialogue with the workers. You know, you see the guy climbing down the outside and, you know, you've got to address him straight away. And I think, and this is why I love your podcast, because you're making health and safety a bit more hip, a bit more fun. And as professionals, we've got to be like that. You know, we've got to be able to go up to that guy instead of going, all right, mate, you know, here's a risk assessment. Why'd you climb down the outside? And rather, you know, talk to him on a level and find out why, you know, why he did that behavior. You know, he said, oh, listen, mate, what, you know, why'd you come down the outside like that? He's, you know, it's dangerous. And, oh, you know, I just want to go and have my lunch quickly. Okay, well, fair enough. You know, do you think if we put in a ladder here, would that be a good idea? Would that, and have that dialogue with him. And because it's those guys, the operators, the builders, the scaffolders, the painters, whatever, they're doing it. And we've got to find out from them, you know, how to make it better and get their input.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, here, as you quite rightly said, you're preaching to the choir here. But I think you're right. I think it's that employee involvement that a lot of businesses just seem – maybe reluctance not the right word, but it seems that they're not very eager to have that employee involvement. And I just think it's the most important thing that we're missing. I mean, it's on all the guidance, it's in the laws, it's everywhere, you know, that you've got to involve your employees, but yet we're still not doing it.
Yeah, and it's I don't know why, but I mean, I do try. I have long discussions with the teams when they're out there, particularly about PPE and how it is that last line of defense. And, you know, I've just got to basically say to the guys, you know, if you're not going to wear your PPE or you're not going to have 100% tie off, you know, the only person you're putting in danger is yourself. And, you know, when you go, that's it. It's done. You know, nobody's going to think twice about you. And, you know, you've really got to try and sort of hit that home to them that, you know, that PPE is it's your final chance, you know. You're only doing yourself in.
In theory, and let's assume we have, but we as a business have done everything we can to reduce this risk, and this PPE is a last line of defence kind of thing, and that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And I think the other side of it is kind of, we've got to kind of target those times when it is high risk, like you were saying, you know, you're down the side of a ship, cleaning the ship, that's pretty high risk. And if you compare that to some of the stuff I see around, you know, people having like 4-page working at height risk assessments for using step ladders to turn electrics off, and it's like, are we really having a 4-page risk assessment for that? What is the need for that? And I think it's that kind of going over the top. It just exacerbates the problem that we're already in.
Yeah, I don't like that approach at all. I mean, a nice little toolbox talk beforehand with a little check card when you just chat to the guys and say, okay, guys, you know, what sort of risks are we looking at? You know, you sometimes get this, you'll get a sort of statement from management, you know, oh, well, we need a risk assessment. I need you to do a risk assessment for this, you know. And my standard answer is, yeah, sure, I'll write you a risk assessment. You know, I'll download one off the net for you. And there you go. But I'm not going to be doing the job. So, there is no point. I can give you a 10-page risk assessment if you want. I think what's a lot more value is doing a job safety analysis with the operator, with the worker, or a little toolbox talk, and getting his feedback, marking it down on a form, and going from there, like you say, rather than a silly 4-page risk assessment that nobody's going to even read.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What's the point? And I think, you know, it does more damage than it does good. It exacerbates that kind of negative attitude of towards health and safety, or health and safety's gone mad. And what that does is, in my opinion, what that does is it makes them disregard it when it is important. So when they have got that risk assessment, and that risk assessment is the right thing to do for that specific task or hazard or whatever, they don't read it because the last risk assessment they read was really over the top. And it just creates this kind of culture that we're in. And I mean, what baffles me, that I mean, if you read the HSE guidance, in my opinion it never really encourages you to go over the top. I always found that it is quite reasonable.
Yeah, I agree with you. It is very reasonable and quite practical as well. We tend to get both sides of the spectrum here. We get a lot of the OSHA stuff from the US. I find their approach is quite different. But yeah, in terms of the HSE stuff out the UK, they don't really ask for a lot, and it seems to be sort of on par. It just some organizations and some companies, they just tend to take it a little bit too far because they think that they're covering themselves from a management standpoint, whereas, as you say, it's actually counterintuitive.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of businesses, they kind of tie themselves up and they kind of make it worse for themselves, like we've just said. But I mean, I think that if we look at the law the kind of UK law from point of view, that it says what it always says. It just says that you've got to assess the risk and manage the risk. But I think where a lot of businesses really get their knickers in a twist is where it defines work at height, and it says work in any place, including a place at or below ground level. And I think that's when people read that one line and they read that they need a risk assessment. And they produce that risk assessment when somebody's just using like an elephant's foot stall or something like that. It says assess the risk. And then they're like, what they don't do, in my opinion, what they don't do is go back to the Health and Safety at Work Act to look, or the Management of Health and Safety at Work Act, and look at what risk assessment is. You know, it doesn't have to be written down other than significant findings. Most of us are going to employ more than 5 people, or the people that we're talking about anyway, so it has to be written down, but still it's only the significant findings. So using an elephant's foot or some steps that you're going on the step ladders for like 2 minutes, it doesn't need a risk assessment.
No, it doesn't. And what I like about the HSC approach is that they don't specify a height. From the OSHA side, they specify 6 feet, 1.8 meters. And, I've been on construction sites where guys have got like scaffolds at 1.79 meters, and they'll tell you, oh, this scaffold doesn't need to be tagged. It's under the, it's under the 1.8 requirement. And I'm like, dude, that's not the intention, If you fall from 1.81 or 1.79, you're still going to do the same damage just because you're building it like this. So you don't have to, so you can build it quickly. And so they just, no idea of the risk.
That's really interesting, actually. And I've obviously never even looked at the kind of American side of things, but that's really interesting because I've always thought the fact that we don't define a height and we are very vague in it, it leads to that misconception or misinterpretation, but actually that's really interesting that they push it that far to be like, 0.1 underneath and just be like, well, it's not applicable.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Yeah, it's strange. And I mean, and actually I do quite a lot of work around fire at the moment, and that pretty much dominates my time. But if we look at it from like a building regs point of view, it will kind of say that it's the same here, because I was reviewing a property a while ago and that we were potentially building, and essentially a wheelchair user had been designed a flat on the second floor, which is fine. But I asked the question, okay, have we given them an evacuation lift? The answer was no. Because we don't need it, because the height of the building is not within building regs to require a firefighting or evacuation lift. Right, okay, fair point. But you've designed a wheelchair user in this flat. But it's stay put. Yeah, but if the fire is in his flat, he needs to evacuate. And you just saw this architect's kind of face go white as a realization set in of what he's actually just done. Luckily we caught it and the outset, and it's been resolved and it's fine. And you could argue that's just an oversight. Architects have got a lot to consider, but it's a fact that because the regulations defined a height and specifically defined a process, they were kind of process blind. And I think that kind of matches what you were saying about the American guidance and regulations.
Yeah, and I mean, if we look at what I see sometimes as well is people, they always consider this working at height, when we go up, and the amount of times I've seen manhole covers left open or trenches, without barricades, and that people just, they don't seem to comprehend this falling down from level ground as well as being an issue. And you see a lot of times these hazards are overlooked because they just, they just fall from height. You also fall down into something as well. And it's something to consider.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is a great point. I just find, if you walk down the streets now at home, like there's just, if anyone is working on the ground whatsoever, there's just massive barriers everywhere. And then one day you'll just walk past some old boy working in the sewer access, and there's no protection around it whatsoever. And we can't seem to find like an even middle ground. It's like all or nothing.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. It's frustrating at the point that like we keep coming back to like the guidance, but I mean, it's simple, just takes us through the kind of simple, and you touched on it earlier when you mentioned like the hierarchy of risk, we got to try and work our way down that, avoid work at height where possible and kind of minimize the distance and the amount of time you're up there and do as much as you can from the ground and all stuff like that. It's simple stuff, isn't it?
Absolutely. And if you go through those basics, I think even if you're not an expert in that, but you work through those steps, you're essentially doing your own little risk assessment there, informal little risk assessment. And they say, okay, it's common sense, but eventually, it does. There's a nice little flow and you can get to it and you can make sure that your guys are protected.
Mm, Definitely. Do you have the same kind of regulations around like the inspections and insurance inspections of say like like lanyards for working at height and fall arrest systems?
Yeah, like personal fall arrest systems. So we specify ours are all to US standards, and I mean the gear is pretty good. We've obviously everything's got Y lanyards or double leg lanyards, so we've got it's always 100% tie off. Every one of our harnesses is also fitted with a suspension trauma strop as well. I don't know if you've seen those.
Yeah, I've heard of them. I've never used them, but
yeah, they're pretty good. So you know, you just roll it out and then you can stand in it, and it takes you off. So that's 100% requirement that they're on every single setup. And those are inspected. They're normally stored in like a sort of a dry indoor air conditioned area, hung up. They have to be hung up a certain way, and then they're inspected every month, obviously before use by the operator or the worker, after use as well. And then we've got the ones with the integrated with sort of inflatable life jackets. That's pretty good gear as well. They've got another inspection regime as well, obviously, because they've got CO2 canisters and things like that. But it's imperative we do these inspections, because they do break down quite quickly in the offshore environment with the corrosion. And obviously we do a lot of blasting of offshore structures and painting, and so you're getting paint on them and thinners, and so they get hammered around a bit. So it's important that we have a really stringent sort of inspection process.
And I suppose that it brings you back again to like culture, is that employees have got to see the importance of that and understand the importance of that. So it all just keeps coming back around to culture.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the guy's got to know that's his bit of gear, and that's what's going to save him at the end of the day. We got to impress on them those personal fall arrest systems. I mean, they're not going to stop you falling. They're only going to help you when you fall. So you've already gone over the side. So you really want to be making sure that it's all working well, because you don't want it to not work well. It could really do you an injury.
Mm. So I suppose that's an interesting point. Like, it sounds like you use fall arrest systems pretty much all the time for your kind of working at height. Whereas I suppose say if we were using, I don't know, like say like a cherry picker on land, always try to use a distance restricting lanyard first, so to stop people being able to reach the edge of the cherry picker or the basket, anchored to hopefully the center of that.
Absolutely. We've got those as well. We've got self-retracting lanyards. It just it depends on the application, because we've got shore facilities here as well. So we've got a lot of construction work that goes on and building. So we'll have four prevention lanyards that, on horizontal lines that'll stop you from getting to the edge. You'll use that in combination with a safety monitor, probably with a whistle. So, he'll give a blast. So it's a double sort of protection. He'll give a blast if he sees you getting too close to the edge, but you've got that prevention as well. Those are good. We've got the LCDs, the ladder climbing devices. I don't know if you've seen those. Those are pretty good as well.
No, if you have. Do you want to take us through what an LCD is? Because I think most listeners will be thinking it's just a nice TV.
Well, we've also got one thing I've got into as well, which is a whole new world, is these high towers. We've got these tower erectors and guys that go up there. So they've got sort of these, like a ladder climbing device. So it's a little lanyard that it's fixed into the ladder, attaches onto his harness. Basically, it's under tension, so it's with him all the way. Obviously, we want him to focus on his three points of contact all the time. But, if he does slip or does go, it'll just basically stop him straight away kind of thing. It's got a little bit of give, but it won't let him go too far. That's a good sort of engineering kind of solution. And then, you know, you obviously with those, you'll have the ladder cages as well, which are added back up.
Yeah, definitely. Are those kind of like the ladder climbing devices? Are they on fixed ladders, or can you have them on portable ladders as well?
No, on fixed ladders.
They're just on fixed ladders.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I don't know. I'm not great on scaffolding. I know enough to sort of get me by and do a good inspection, but I don't know if they use them in scaffolding, if they've got sort of a big fixed scaffold, if that's not really my area, but I suppose it's something they could look at.
Yeah, I like innovation, things like that. That's what we're desperate for, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you never, with safety, you know, you're never at a position where you're just safe and you can say, okay, guys, that's it, we're good, we can stop. You've always got to be, looking and trying to get ahead and, you know, look for new ideas, because it's always changing.
Yeah, definitely. So I suppose we kind of touched on it again, and I'm just sitting here thinking, like, I suppose in your kind of industry, you inherently work with quite highly competent people. Would that be correct?
Yeah, we try to, obviously, we try to get people competent, and, you know, I think you had a discussion a couple of weeks ago, competency, you know, what is competency? And it's built on a couple of things. So like your skills, your knowledge, your experience, your training, and this all goes into, you know, are you competent or not? But also we like to try and look at a level above that. And this is something I think where the industry can really learn from, in terms of mastery. When you talk about a person mastering a skill, you know, you get like, let's give an example, an analogy, like a footballer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You got a guy who plays third division football. Yeah. He's got the skills. He's got the knowledge. He knows the rules. He's got the experience. He's had his training, but, you know, he's not playing for Man United. Eh? He's not a master footballer. And those, so we can have a lot of competent people, and that's good, but we need to have those people that are masters in their fields and master those skills, and because those are the guys that are going to help you when it all goes wrong. And we tend to, in the industry, when it does go wrong, we look at the guy that's messed up and we talk about his competent, you know, was he competent? And we look at the management systems that led to him not having the competence and that ended up in that incident or accident. But all those times in industry when these guys do amazing things on the front line in operations, these outstanding operators, these outstanding engineers that saved the day, we never focus in on their behaviors and their actions and learn from that and build up the whole workforce and say, okay, well, we've got competent guys, but let's get them up to another level. Let's have them be masters of their skill sets and their disciplines. And and I think that's something we could look at.
Yeah, I like that. And then, you know what, you're only kind of introducing an additional kind of, if they're masters in their own industry or their own area within that business. So say, I don't know, say for example, they were a machine operator, bring it back to kind of my world. If they were masters in that machine, you know, when we go and do a risk assessment and they're involved, you know, not to big myself up, but to use your kind of terminology, I would be the master of safety. And then you would probably have an engineer who's the master of the actual machine and the components. And that creates like an awesome collection of people that know this process inside and out. And that creates only what can be an amazing risk assessment, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And when you involve the operators who are going to be doing that task with those people, you know, those experts, they're going to learn, and their competence levels are going to be brought up. So we don't, you know, we don't just, okay, he's competent, he's gone through this process, industry says he's competent, okay, great. But now, as an organization, as you know, our duty of care and you know, our due diligence, we're going to bring him up to another level by making sure he understudies a guy who has mastery of these skills and is involved in creating these risk assessments, these job safety analysis, that he's going to, you know, he's going to be affecting every single day, day in, day out. When that health and safety expert's gone and that foreman that's an expert's not going to be there, we've given this guy a little bit more.
And I suppose you would kind of, would you kind of like tier the competencies? So say somebody who the likelihood for work, let's stick with working at height, the likelihood for them, one person, say on a ship or on land or wherever, was to only go maybe use a ladder every now and then, they would maybe have just a reasonable level of competence and awareness or an understanding of, you know, safe use of a ladder, for example, whereas somebody who's likely to be using harnesses and fall arrest systems and be working on MEWPs or scaffolding would probably have a much higher level of competence. Would you say that's applicable offshore as well? Or
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I suppose it's that, it's that kind of bit that we miss maybe, I think, on land. I think, well, maybe we don't miss it, but like, I think, if you've got like kind of like safe working loads and, you know, resistance and stuff of and kind of testing of anchorage points and things like that that you would need for ball arrest systems and things like that, and you don't need that stuff for ladders, you know, you don't get a ladder really that has quite clearly a safe working load written on the side of it or anything like that.
No.
And it, but it's that kind of tiered approach that I think we need, and yeah, being aware of that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there are things that you can have the guy look, you know, we look at a ladder, it's a really simple device, but you know, we can just, before, when we do the little toolbox talk with him as a supervisor with the worker, you know, we look at those basic things on the ladder, you know, in terms of the grip on the bottom, you know, is everything, all the rungs okay, there's nothing sticking out, you know, it's not got paint all over it, all the non-slip surfaces are, they're all intact. And you know, once you've looked at the equipment and spoken to him about, you know, angles and not going up to the, you know, staying the third step from the top is maximum point, and a buddy system, two guys working together, then, you know, you can talk to him about his actual approach on the ladder and his 3 points of contact and how he ascends and descends.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing we're missing. And I say that, but like, you know, I was painting my spare bedroom a few weeks back and fell off my ladder. So, you know, I'm kind of being a bit hypocritical sitting here, but it's in that moment that I kind of say to myself, like, right, if you were at work now, you would have done that differently. You wouldn't have. Lent on that ladder, you would have stopped, moved it, or you would have told somebody else that they shouldn't be leading on it. So why did you just do it? And yeah, it's that complacency of risk. In my house, I felt quite competent to do the work I was needing to do, and I felt very safe because I was in my house, and yeah, completely disregarded those kind of little simple checks. And I think what they're kind of trying to bring it round to is that kind of mindfulness, like being mindful of what you are doing or what I was doing in that second, you know, oh, hang on a minute, I'm on a ladder and I'm leaning over. If I was mindful of that, I would have stopped it, got down, moved the ladder over. I think it's that kind of, it's also being lazy as well.
Yeah, I don't know why we do it as humans sometimes, these at-risk behaviors. Like in my safety talks, I always use that analogy, you know, when you've got an elevator and the doors are closing, and what do? We put our hand in between the doors. You know, instead of just standing back and waiting 1 minute for it to come back, we stick our hand in between these two metal doors to, you know, and those sensors, they're normally sort of, I don't know, thigh height or whatever. So you never get it, and then the things close. And I just don't know why we do that as humans, though, these. And we've got to really, in terms of our culture, we've got to look at those at-risk behaviors, find out why we do them, and just like not do them.
Yeah, I suppose it's that we've engineered safety out so well that, you know, if you look at it, the likelihood of you know, you put your hand in between the doors of a lift, the likelihood of that failing and then continuing to crush your arm, in theory, should be extremely low. But yeah, I can understand what you're saying. You know, if you were to go back 20, 30, 40 years, probably much longer than that, actually, maybe like 50, 60 years, and say, in the future, I will put my hand in front of these two automatically closing doors to let somebody else on the lift or to try and get on the lift in time. They would laugh you out of the door. And I think if you think of that kind of analogy, and I don't know if you have been on there any time recently, but if you go to like London Underground, the tube system there in rush hour, people jumping onto trains as the doors are closing, it just blows my mind. Like,
yeah, terrible.
It just blows my mind. And you know, I've seen people that get their bags stuck in the door. I've seen people get their head stuck in the door. And I mean, they hit their head and then they stop and the door's open. That's fine. It doesn't really hurt. But it's just a fundamental, like, kind of flaw there, isn't there? That you've just run into a train with a closing door because you didn't want to wait for the next one. And there is nine times out of ten, there is always a train like 2 minutes later.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And you want to sort of sit down and talk to people and just say, what, why? You know, but one day that door's going to close and it's not going to stop.
Mm.
And you're going to be a goner for what, 2 minutes?
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's that kind of like slowing life down, isn't it? Just kind of take a step back, slow down a little bit, and just look at what you're doing.
Absolutely, mate. And that is a key statement, and that is so true, especially with safety and especially with working at heights. You know, the job's going to get done. Just step back, take a breath, talk about it. Let's see, and let's just go through it nice and easy, you know. The job will get done.
Yeah, that's a great point. And if we kind of bring it back to me on that stepladder, you know, and the way I landed on my foot, I'm surprised that I didn't snap my ankle. And, you know, after that, I look at it and I think, you know, I could have snapped my ankle there and that would have really hurt. And also, I'm quite proud to say I've never broke a bone, and I would have had to have said I broke a bone now. And it's just... If I'd have just slowed down, all I needed to do was just slow down a little bit. There was no rush to what I was doing. There was no deadline. There was no pressure. Just slow down, take a step back and look. Would I have moved the ladder? I don't know. I can't really answer that question. It's impossible. But I'd like to think I would have if I'd have slowed down.
Yeah, it's an excellent point.
Mm. And I think I was talking to a colleague of mine about this, and he said the kind of timelines and pressures to do work inherently put a lot of pressure on the workers to inherently cut corners. And I said, well, what if we, just as a business, decided that we were going to add 10% onto every single timeline? So if we said it were going to take, you know, so many weeks, we would take that number, add 10% onto it, and that's a couple more weeks. Okay, great. What's that for? Well, just to be safe. Just to slow people down, just to calm down. Would that make a difference? Or would we just get so used to adding 10% that then 10 years down the line, we would then need to add 20%?
I think I think the key here is, you know, you hear a lot of companies, they'll say things like that, or, you know, you always hear the safety first and safety before operations. Whereas we're talking about integrating them more. Safety with operations, and so that it's all built in together. So you don't have to look at them separately and go, okay, we want to slow down because we want to be safe. So we'll build this in to be safe. No, we'll do it all together, and we'll do it safely and efficiently. But it's all going to be integrated together. Safety and operations are going to go hand in hand. And I think if we've got that sort of that paradigm, that shift in thinking, where safety and operations are integrated, then that kind of argument, like you say, yeah, 10%, then becomes 20%, then becomes 30%, then that becomes sort of a moot point or becomes void.
Yeah, that's a great point. I was reading my book was it in that book? I can't remember. It was either in... I can't remember what the bloody book was. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is that I read somewhere that basically if you say that safety is first, your first priority, then essentially you're lying to yourself. And I think I've said this in the podcast before, like you're lying to the business, you're lying to your staff, and you're lying to your customers, because safety is not first. Every business's priority is to stay in business. That's the first priority. So should safety be a second priority or third priority? No, I think you're bang on. It shouldn't be anywhere. It should just be ingrained in what you do. It should essentially, the safety heaven is that people like me and you, our jobs don't exist in theory. We are specialists that are requested for very specialist things to provide specialist advice. But the general safety side of it just happens. You are just done by doing it inherently in your job, kind of thing, if that makes sense. The operations managers would do the risk assessments as a team with their operators and blah, blah, and the engineers and so on. You would kind of create a world where safety is just there.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you follow the... do you follow the Safety Differently group on LinkedIn?
Yeah.
And I mean, I love all of that... And they sort of really looking at that now with that Sydney Decker, and they did a big study out in Oz with one of the supermarket groups, and they took like three different locations, and they decoupled safety from operations in sort of three different percentages. You know, it was like 25% decoupled, 50% decoupled, and then 75% decoupled. Obviously, they got permission from the regulator, and they found that the supermarket where they decoupled it the most, you know, where the safety guys had stood back and the operations staff were looking at their safety, they were the ones who were getting the best sort of their performance measures, their KPIs, and were the best. So, yeah. Operations are doing it all the time. You know, they understand the work. Obviously, they they generally doing it safely, aren't they? I mean, we're not killing people every single day. We have these incidents. Of course, we do. But you know, generally, we do it safely. And we've got to look at that, look at those behaviors, look and reward them and encourage that and just embed it in them. And that's the way to go forward.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like you were saying about like reward there, like I was going to say something else, but then when you said that, I was like, that is spot on. Like we spend so much time looking in the past and being negative as safety professionals. And, you know, we never really celebrate the good, because the good is expected. Like I was talking about manual handling on another podcast that's come out in a couple of weeks with, Stephen Melvin, and we're just talking about like if I could go back and when I was working in like factories and warehouses and stuff like that, I would do it so differently. Like if I saw somebody lifting correctly, I would just go over and be like, nice job, mate, well done, give them a high five, or, you know, be really extrovert and just be like, yes, great job. And then the person I see not lifting correctly, the first time I see it, I probably wouldn't say anything. And then the second time I see it, I might go over and just do a little toolbox talk, just privately, me and that person, just say, hey, why are you lifting like that? And then find out that maybe the problem is the process or the way the environment is settled, or that person's got a bad back anyway or something like that. But actually, if we just go around and encourage good behavior, then we create a positive environment that people just want to be good.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we're coming back to that point where we spoke about in terms of how we interact with people as safety professionals. And you know, we want to sort of move forward and not be, you know, not be that like guy that nobody wants to listen to. And if we, like you said, that little toolbox talk with that guy, you know, you just take him aside and, you sort of, if your safety professional, he's trained in emotional intelligence. He can practice reflective listening. He can display empathy. He's going to get a lot more in that toolbox talk if he applies all of those kind of those behaviors rather than, all right, mate, you know, listen, this is how you need to do it. You know, here's your 10-page sure. risk assessment.
And do you know what? There's some awesome kind of like, I don't want to use the phrase buzzwords because that doesn't really do them justice, but like those kind of couple of key words you mentioned there about like being emotionally intelligent, understanding empathy and things like that. Now we're talking about like the soft skills that the safety professionals are missing, and there's kind of coaching as opposed to being an advisor.
Yeah. And that's something that the industry could look at as well, and making maybe that part of safety professional training, or, you know, even with operations managers and things like that.
For sure. And it's just kind of understanding the environment they're in as well, you know, and the challenges that they undergo. You know, we could come along and I always kind of use my manual handling training as a trainer experience. The first place I had to deliver manual handling training was in a factory where we made bubble wrap that was inherently as light as a feather. No matter how big these rolls were, they were lifting sheets of plastic with air inside of it. Telling a room of men that they've got to lift this by bending their knees and looking at this, I just got laughed out of the room. and it was just that kind of, well, hang on, let's not look at this like walking around like a toy soldier and stuff. Let's be reasonable here. What if we just bent our knees ever so slightly and used our arms a little bit more and just worked that kind of kinetic, efficient, ergonomic way where we're using everything? And it turns out they ended up coming over and saying, actually, we're just quicker and we just feel better by just slightly bending our knees, not bending all the way to the ground, not going OTT, just that slight little bit of a change. But it involved involvement and empathy and coaching and all of those things and conversations and to a key point, employee involvement. We couldn't have done that without them.
Yeah, and what you said there, that last point, people conversations are so critical. For them to take place, the more you talk in that, and that's how you get those small little victories, you know. So and they come back, and yeah, he's going to bend his knees a little bit, and you know, everybody's going to be a bit safer and a bit more efficient, and it's win-win.
Yeah for sure. I just think, like, when we come back to all this stuff and we look at it all, they're all just so basic fundamentals, aren't they? Like, use competent people and have conversations and understand what they're doing and understand what you're doing, maintain equipment. Yeah, these are just simple basics of just business, surely.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's absolutely nuts. I was just thinking it's worth kind of mentioning specifically on, like, working at height, that the HSE guidance does actually quote 30 minutes as like a short duration. So is that something that you guys would consider? Like, if you're on 30 minutes is a long time, and probably at sea, it's 30 minutes on a ladder is quite a long time. So would you maybe cut that shorter and just say, you know, actually just working on a ladder for 10 minutes is quite hot, risky at sea? Or
yeah, absolutely. And I think you just got to look at each task as it is, and you know, when you've done that toolbox talk and you've discussed how long it's going to be and the objectives and look at the hazards and the risks and you've spoken to each other and you've got the feedback. I don't think you need to be tied into times and limits like that. I think you've got to keep quite dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that's a fundamental part of the nature of your industry. As like you said earlier, you know, the sea and the weather and everything, the environment can change by the flip of a coin.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing we didn't mention was rescue. I don't know if
it's a good point.
If you've had much experience with rescue at heights in that, or
no, you've probably got a lot more experience than that than me. So you take that.
Yeah, I mean, there we obviously you don't want it to happen. So we generally for the bigger jobs in that we'll have a rescue plan in place beforehand, so we know what we're capable of. You don't want a guy just hanging there from a suspended scaffold and you find that you can't reach him. So it's critical when we go around the job site, because we'll always do a job site inspection before a bigger job. So you'll go around together before you issue the permits in that. And these are the kind of things you'll look at, you know. We'll have like a standard plan for the site. And then because it changes all the time with scaffolding and where you work and how you build it and on these structures. And then every time we do the job site inspection in the morning, we'll go around and we'll look at that rescue again, and just work through a checklist and just see if we can, you know, we can reach these places in that.
So would you do that just in a team just before? Is that kind of part of that risk assessment before the task goes out then?
Yeah. So we'll, you know, obviously we'll assess the risk assessment will be done before the job starts. We'll have a toolbox talk with the team. We will issue work permits in that. And then prior to issuing the work permit, the permit issuer and receiver, they will go around the whole job site. They'll do a job site inspection together. And then for working at heights, we'll have a specific checklist that they go through, including a rescue checklist as well. And we just got to make sure that we're all covered in terms of where the guys are working and, you know, if he goes here, how are we going to get him? Because if he's suspended over the water and we've got to look at sort of getting a vessel underneath with a man basket up to him, we've got to know that we can do that, and we've got to know we can do it within the time that suspension trauma could set in.
That's such really interesting. How would you kind of deal with that? So from like an emergency point of view, or maybe not, well, emergency, yes, but also kind of like a high pressure role. So something needs to be done real quick, you know, and you haven't got the time to go through that permit system. Would you still kind of go through that, or would that be like a kind of dynamic assessment or something like that?
You'll do a dynamic assessment. And I think the main thing about those emergencies is that you've got pre-incident plans in place, so it doesn't become something you've never seen before. We've got another sort of format where one of our SMS elements will look at all these sort of credible emergency scenarios, and we'll rate them in that. And for each one, we'll have pre-incident plans ready. And obviously, because working at heights is such a big risk for us, these pre-incident plans are pretty well structured and thought out. And we bring in some, very high up SMEs from our corporate teams and that to kind of come and look at these. These are guys, you know, who are experts in these fields. So we've got to make sure that, yeah, there's going to be times where you're going to have to do work quite, emergency work quite quickly, but you've got to work that into your credible emergency scenarios beforehand, so you at least have some idea. You know, you don't want to be faced with something completely new, because you're then going to struggle.
So you do a hell of a lot of work before to really really try and minimize the opportunity of that the normal process, the normal kind of critical control points not being able to be carried out. So you're trying to minimize that from the outset.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we also look at business continuity management as well, you know, so you've got that, I don't know if you've had experience with those. So if you've got, you know, if you have an incident like
BCPs,
that.
BCPs, yeah. So most of my BCP stuff probably the two, so from the NHS, kind of my experience of BCP probably different, kind of would be like, how do we keep a hospital going if we lose electricity? How do we deal with like a terrorism attack? How do we deal with a major fire? things like that. That's probably my experience of BCP from how it worked from the NHS mainly. That was probably where the biggest thing, the biggest impact of that, or the biggest focus of that was. And then in housing, it's quite similar as well. Less terrorism, but more fire.
Yeah, I mean, you've got your, you like sort of distinguish between the two. You're going to respond to the emergency, but then, you know, you also want your business operations, that sort of graph where it dips really far down. You don't want that trough to be so deep, you know, your business continuity sort of kicks in and you try and get these other processes and operations up and running again. So you can, you know, you try and make it seamless, so it doesn't affect the business as such while you are responding to the emergency. So, you know, that's another aspect we look at as well.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Absolutely awesome. I think we could probably sit here all day and talk about this, wouldn't we?
But yeah, mate. It's a great, safety's a great topic, you know. It's, lots to talk about.
Yeah, I think I had a call the other day for another podcast that's coming out in a couple of weeks with Rachel Butler, who works around like construction, but she's quite famous in the safety world, or especially on land anyway. I don't know if you know, but she was like the youngest chartered IOSH in the UK.
Oh, wow.
The youngest female chartered IOSH. That's right. I always say the wrong one. We were talking about, you know, how do we get, you know, these young professionals, these young people to choose safety as a career. It's kind of, just trying to get away from that kind of persona that we've got, because actually when you really start talking about this stuff, like you've just gone through something that I think as a child I'd be like, wow, that's really cool, you know, business continuity on a ship after working at height and emergency planning and rescue plans and stuff like that. That's some really cool shit.
Absolutely.
It's just kind of trying to break that barrier and just kind of look at it, and I think you can't really, there's probably no other industry that you could have a safety professional. It's everywhere, isn't it? You can't have a safety professional. You can have one in hospitals, in housing, in construction, and then you have them on offshores and ships and everything. And it's absolutely everywhere. In my opinion, it's such an overlooked career that I love it.
Yeah, I do as well. And the fact that we you and I can just sit and talk about, you know, from completely different industries, but we can talk about principles that are essentially the same wherever you go. It's, you know, and we could probably talk for another 5 hours. It's great.
Yeah, and that is actually such a great point. Like, the fundamentals are always the same. You know, what if you've got equipment, maintain it. If you're doing something, what's the risk? This is the risk. Manage that risk.
Yeah.
That's it. And that's it. And you know, on a daily basis, I get emails, you know, what's the law say? It says the same as it says yesterday. Assess the risk, manage the risk, maintain what you got. Yeah. Not sure of it, that's what it says.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's no different in working at height. You know, the guidance gives you the kind of, you know, short duration, 30 minutes. It does give you those things. It gives you those kind of guidelines to follow, but we're going to follow this back all the way to the law. What does it say? It says the same thing. Manage the risk, follow the principles of prevention, try and avoid it, try and mitigate it. These are basic stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's starting to get like a quite a boring podcast, because I end up just talking about these fundamentals all the time. Same thing. Always comes back to culture and assess risk. And, you know, how many podcasts can you do on how to assess risk? But it's the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got to hammer that point home, and, you know, come back to what we spoke about at the beginning. This basic skill of being able to recognize the hazard in our operators and our workers is just so fundamental to the business and the operation. And, you know, if we can just embed this in the guys before they even get onto the site, with a really good program, okay, you're going out there and this is what you got to look out for, guys. This is what's going to hurt you. And, you know, if you hurt you can't work. And if you can't work, you can't get money. And, you know, that's what it boils down to. We're there to earn cash, and really try and inject that culture and that ability for them to see the things that are going to cause them danger and be able to not have those at-risk behaviors. And you know, then your job's done.
Yeah, they kind of self-manage themselves, don't they? It's like self-safety. Oh, that's good.
I like that.
Yeah, self-safety. There we go. There's another alliteration for you, a little buzzword.
Add a hashtag onto that, eh?
Definitely. I heard a good one the other day. I was reading Andrew Sharman and Dame Judith Hackett's book. What's it called? Oh, bloody hell. How to get safety just right or something like that. I can't remember. But it's basically what your MDA didn't teach you about health and safety. And there's a good one in there. They say about spazzy safe. And I was like, what is that? And essentially spazzy safe is pretty much what every business I've seen currently operates in, where that knee jerk reaction safety. So we've got it massively in fire at the moment. You know, Grenfell happened and everyone's essentially shit themselves and just gone way over the top. They're evacuating buildings and, you know, ripping cladding off and stuff like this. And you're like, whoa, calm down. Let's look at the fundamental flaws here. And it's the same thing. We all, in everything, we've got these kind of spazzy safe reactions. And if we look at working at height, this is a great example. You know, when they brought these regulations out, the construction industry went to its knees in a day because they thought that they'd banned ladders.
Yeah.
To the point where in their guidance, it states in the HSE guidance, you know, take a sensible approach when considering precautions at work. There may be some low risk situations where common sense tells you no particular precautions are necessary. The law recognizes it. There's a common misconception that ladders and step ladders are banned, but this is not the case.
Yeah.
They've literally put it in writing for you. Like, yeah, common absolutely. Sense.
Clear as day.
It's right there, but it's that, you know, so it's on people like us, it's on our industry to just keep reiterating that. And I always find, you know, asking those people, they come to you, oh, can I use a ladder? What do you think? Well, you're the professional. No, I'm a safety professional. Do you think you can use a ladder? You're the professional at your job. Do you think you can use a ladder? And they end up doing a risk assessment themselves just by leading the conversation.
Yeah.
And I find sometimes that's much more effective.
Yeah, that is effective.
Well, Daniel, that was an absolutely awesome conversation. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and an awesome kind of insight into the offshore world and the complexities of that. And I think if you'll come back, I think we would definitely have you back on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, James. I've really loved to. I just got into them. Podcasts again after many years, and I got into your one. I think the first one I listened to was with Christian Harris, the slip guy.
Yeah,
which is also something I was involved with a few years ago, so I really sort of enjoyed that. But thank you for having me. I really love your approach, and I'd love to be back. It'd be my pleasure.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for listening. I hope that's brought you value. If it has brought you value, click like and subscribe. And if you're on YouTube, don't forget to click the bell. If you're on iTunes, don't forget to rate and review this podcast. We really, really appreciate your feedback, and it just helps us improve. If you have not shared this podcast yet, I'm watching. Share it. Get this message out there, people. Peace out. Safe.